Hello and welcome to Employment Law Matters. This week we're looking at performance dismissals. I'm playing extracts from a webinar I did with Saul Margot of Outer Temple Chambers, and the things you'll hear include: do warnings impact a performance management process? What are the benefits and the pitfalls of settlement agreements for underperforming employees? And when can you move straight to dismissal for poor performance? This is the last episode of Season 6 of Employment Law Matters. This episode is dropping on the 13th of June, 2023. I'm Barrister Daniel Barnett, a member of Outer Temple Chambers, same chambers as Saul Margot. I'm the presenter of The Legal Hour on LBC Radio, and I'm the founder of the HR Inner Circle. Throughout this season, I'm picking my favourite 12 webinars from the series of 30 employment law webinars that I ran in 2021, in each of which a top employment lawyer answered your questions over Zoom. We had hundreds of solicitors and HR professionals submitting questions on the different topics. I've not only picked my favourite 12 episodes, this is one of them, but I've selected the best half dozen or so questions and answers from each of those episodes just for you. As I mentioned, this week we're looking at performance dismissals with Saul Margot. But before I introduce Saul, since it's the last episode of the season, let me just say thank you. Thank you for listening for the last 12 weeks. It's been great fun for me revisiting these old webinars and putting these podcasts together. Thanks also to Breeden Consulting and Radar for supporting the season. Without them, this podcast wouldn't be possible. If you're interested in supporting the next season of Employment Law Matters, have a look at go.danielbarnett.com/sponsor for some information about our sponsorship package. Each episode has between 3,000 and 6,000 downloads, plus the two sponsors of my podcast each season get shout-outs to my 18,000 Twitter followers and appear in my emails promoting this podcast, which go out to 33,000 people. If you want to know more about how to sponsor Season 7, contact me via go.danielbarnett.com/sponsor. Saul Margot, who you are going to hear in a moment, is ranked by Chambers and Partners and the Legal 500 as a leading junior in both employment and pensions, as well as extensive experience of the full range of conventional employment-related disputes. He has a particular specialism in the crossover between employment and pensions, having been instructed in the litigation relating to the judge's pension scheme, the police pension scheme, and sexual orientation discrimination claims relating to the teacher's pension scheme. Saul also sits as a fee-paid judge in the employment tribunals in Watford and Reading. Here's Saul Margot.
Welcome to Employment Law Matters with Barrister Daniel Barnett.
First of all, Saul Margot, can an employer take into account a live conduct warning, when issuing a capability warning?
Okay, well, I think in the vast majority of cases, that would be a mistake. You know, capability and conduct are both potentially fair reasons for dismissal, but they are distinct concepts under the Employment Rights Act. So, I mean, capability is defined as meaning capability assessed by reference to skill, aptitude, health, or any other physical or mental quality. So here, obviously, we're talking about performance. So that's skill or aptitude. And that is conceptually different from conduct. There can be cases where you could use either label. So, for example, it could be a case where there's a very senior individual who shows a significant level of incompetence when they must or should have known better, and that might shade into misconduct. Or, you know, perhaps cases where the extent of the training that's been given means that a particular failing by an employee feels like misconduct rather than capability. But, you know, in the vast majority of cases, I think those processes, the conduct and capability processes, should be kept separate, with capability focusing on identifying the performance issue, setting clear goals, providing opportunity to improve over a particular period of time, potentially providing further support or training that's needed. Now, those steps wouldn't normally be features of a conduct process. And I think that underlines the risk of confusing the two. If you do so, if you confuse them by taking into account of this live conduct warning you mentioned, you know, capability process, I just think you risk muddying the waters. You're going to make life harder for yourself down the road, particularly if you have to defend the dismissal at the employment tribunal, so I'd advise against it. Even the pros are sometimes muted, which is good to see.
What about if the issues are sometimes mushed up? So, yeah. For example, the essence of the allegation being brought against the employee is that although they're naturally very good at a job, they're just not doing it because they're being lazy, because they're distracted, because they can't be bothered, because they're dissatisfied with the pay rise, that sort of thing.
Well, as I say, I mean, sometimes it's recognised in the case law that sometimes these issues are hard to distinguish. That can be the case sometimes, and the distinction can be not very clear. And obviously, if you end up at an employment tribunal, the tribunal isn't going to be obsessed with labels. They're going to be looking at the fairness of the dismissal. And if the employer has given it the wrong label, they will still look at what the right label is and whether the dismissal is fair. But I think that the problem is that if you put something in the wrong box, then you do risk following the wrong procedure. So I certainly think that you might come to a situation where you think, well, hang on, you know, we initially gave a conduct warning there, but you know what, I think that this isn't just kind of negligence or carelessness from this employee. I think this is actually capability, and I want to take that warning into account, but go forward in the capability process. I think you can do that, but you just have to have a very clear sight of what it is you're doing and why, and perhaps acknowledging that you actually see it in a different light now.
Some employers just take the view that if you've got an underperforming employee, assuming they've got more than 2 years employment, the best thing to do is get them to sign a settlement agreement to leave rather than going through performance management. Is that an approach you'd recommend? Does it have pitfalls?
Well, I mean, I think from an employer's point of view, you know, it's something that's likely to be attractive, as you say, if they do not want to go through the time and effort of a capability procedure, especially if it's thought that process is bound to or very likely to fail. And you know, the advantage would obviously be get it done early and avoid that lengthy process. Now, in terms of how it would be done, I would have thought the sensible approach would be to have a pre-termination negotiation that can't be relied on in ordinary unfair dismissal cases. So this exception we have now under Section 111A of the Employment Rights Act. So in principle, you know, you can have those conversations without being worried about, in particular, constructive dismissal claims. You don't have to be worried that you've undermined trust and confidence in some way and they've resigned and can bring that claim. I mean, I think that the real issues can arise if those conversations are had too soon and at a time when it's a complete shock to the employee. So in particular, if those managers have been avoiding having those difficult conversations, you suddenly seek to have a conversation about a settlement agreement. The problems that can arise is that there are circumstances in which those negotiations can be relied upon, and that is anything that is not an ordinary unfair dismissal claim. So if there's a claim for discrimination or if there's a suggestion of some improper behaviour, the employee can refer to those discussions. Just seems to me that if you move too quickly, then you could encourage the view from the employee that something improper is going on that perhaps isn't actually about their performance, you know, whether that's the case or not. So I think it's much better or more appropriate to move to these, you know, pre-termination discussions at a time when those performance concerns have been discussed. You've had those difficult conversations. It's not coming as a shock, but before the formal procedure has been initiated, so you can make those savings of time and expense.
Last question for me, Saul Margo, before we go to the questions that people have sent in. Imagine you're an employer who hires maternity cover to cover a woman who's off on maternity leave, and the person filling in comes to you and says, look at all these mistakes that my predecessor made, and you realise there are real performance issues with the woman who's on maternity leave. how should an employer handle performance issues that it's become aware of during maternity leave?
Well, I think the first thing I'd say is that obviously, you should not be initiating any formal capability procedure during the maternity leave. I think the reason for that is quite a practical one, that you're not going to be able to assess whether their performance is improving. And a fair process is likely going to require a chance for you to explore the reasons for the poor performance, set clear goals and give them a chance to improve. And if they're absent on maternity leave, you're not going to be able to do that. I think that the real issue then becomes whether you bring it to their attention at all. What do you do? They're out of the office or maternity leave. And I would say that on balance, again, I would say that the best approach is not to raise it with them while they're absent on maternity leave, because you're not going to be able to follow up on it in any event during the leave. So, apart from those practical considerations, there's obviously the welfare of the individual to think about and the risk of a potential or encouraging a potential claim of discrimination under Section 18 of the Equality Act and treating them unfavourably because of pregnancy or maternity leave. Now, you can discipline people during maternity leave, but again, in this situation, I think there are practical reasons that would really point against it. So, what should you do? I think that it would at the very least be sensible to capture the information. So make sure that you record the poor performance, that you carry out, if there's some kind of investigation to carry out at this initial stage, you capture the information so that you can address it if necessary when the individual returns. But I don't think realistically it would be right or sensible to move forward with it in any procedural way while they're absent.
Quick interruption from me, I'll only be 15 seconds. Two requests, please. Number one, if you've got any friends or colleagues who might benefit from subscribing to this podcast, please send them the link, go.danielbarnett.com/subscribe. Second of all, please do leave a review on whatever podcast software or system you use. It does make all the difference. Thanks. Now back to the episode. Question from Sue Apps. Sue asks, will it always be necessary in performance dismissals to go through a warning, final written warning, and dismissal with performance improvement plans, targets, support, etc. each time to improve at each stage? Can you give any examples, Sulmargo, of where you could fairly move straight to dismissal for performance reasons?
Okay, well, I conveniently have the ACAS code. I always have the ACAS code of open. No, so I do have the ACAS code here. I mean, the ACAS code disciplinary and grievance procedures, this is general guidance, and actually the code doesn't actually distinguish or give a totally separate process for performance versus misconduct, which is quite interesting. So paragraph 19, where misconduct is confirmed or the employee is found to be performing unsatisfactorily, it is usual to give the employee a written warning. A further act of misconduct or failure to improve performance within a set period would normally result in a final written warning. 20, if an employee's first misconduct or unsatisfactory performance is sufficiently serious, it may be appropriate to move directly to a final written warning. This might occur where the employee's actions had or are liable to have a serious or harmful impact on the organisation. So, I mean, I think what you can see there, and there is other guide, there's also the ACAS guide on disciplinary and grievance procedures from July 2020 that gives other non-statutory guidance here. And what you can see there is the way the code puts it is that in a sufficiently serious case, you could move straight to a final written warning. So it's not suggesting that you might move straight to dismissal. Wouldn't rule that out completely. It can sometimes happen. Obviously, what you'd be looking at is very, very serious act of something probably bordering on gross negligence. Again, it might be one of those cases that actually looks more like misconduct, but something where it's so basic, it's so clear, it's so obvious, they've had such complete and full training that it's just obvious that they are not going to be able to do the job. Thinking more broadly about capability, I suppose other examples, might be where you have just some complete inability to do some particular key area of the role. So let's say you have to be able to perform control and restraint because you work in a prison. And it's become absolutely clear that you'll never be able to do that. And there's just no way around it. And it's clear there's no way around it in terms of adjustments that say it's disability related. And I suppose in principle, you could move quickly there, but it's going to be very, very rare, I think, is the answer. And I could perhaps be more creative in trying to think of answers, but it'll be very rare.
I think one of my favourite cases from law school, and it's just one of the very few cases I always remember, is called Alidair and Taylor, where an airline, Alidair, flew, I think, between Plymouth.
This is the negligent pilot, isn't
it? It's the negligent pilot. Yes, okay. Flew between Exeter and the Channel Islands. And Captain Taylor, on one occasion, had a really hard landing. No one was hurt, but it was a hard, negligent landing. But he had the misfortune that the wife of the airline's chief executive was on the plane at the time. And he got fired for poor performance. And the Court of Appeal basically said that there was no obligation to put him through a first warning, second warning, etc. They said some things are so serious that you just can't allow somebody a chance to develop a track record.
Radar is a specialist commercial and litigation law firm dedicated to helping businesses navigate their risk, including employment issues. Radar's legal expertise and innovative digital tools focus on educating businesses before problems happen. Book your free 30-minute employment and HR consultation today, or subscribe to their monthly newsletter at Radar, that's RRADAR, radar.com/employment.
Natalie has another question. Natalie White, do you have any general guidance, Saul Margot, about what a reasonable time frame is for allowing employees the chance to improve before dismissal?
No. I don't. I mean, you know, I think, Natalie, you know, the reality is that, you know, you've got to look at the particular circumstances of that employment. So, I mean, you know, I'm just trying to think of random examples. I mean, you know, somebody's a junior journalist in a paper and you don't think their writing style is good enough. And you say, you know, by next week, it needs to be better. Well, you know, that's just not realistic. They're not going to improve their writing style by next week. It's no employment tribunal is going to look at that and think that it's a realistic or reasonable time frame. They're going to think it's a stitch up, you know, that your mind has been made up and you're just going through the motions. So I think you look at the industry, the manager is going to be given a wide discretion by an employment tribunal in terms of the period of where improvement is feasible. But that's really what you're thinking about. You know, what would a tribunal think when looking at this? Would they say that this is just outside the range of reasonable responses? Is it just not feasible? Or is this a fair attempt by a manager to give them a chance?
Breeden Consulting provides small and medium businesses with the breadth of HR support usually enjoyed by large corporates. So if you want practical and commercially focused HR support, or if you're an HR professional looking for an opportunity to capitalize on your experience by joining a great team, visit www.breedenconsulting, that's B-R-E-E-D-O-N, breedenconsulting.co.uk.
Really nice question from Helen Longton. Helen asks, if an employer has a performance improvement policy, which provides at the final stage, if an employee hasn't achieved the required standards, they can be demoted or redeployed as an alternative to dismissal if they agree, then if the employer tries to demote or redeploy them and the employee refuses, is that a dismissal or a resignation?
Well, I think what you would... So, it is an interesting question. I mean, I actually went in a different direction than I expected, but no doubt that's a sign of a good question, Helen. I think that you'd probably end up dismissing them, wouldn't you? I mean, you know, in the way you framed your question, they haven't actually resigned. Yeah, they might do. But so I think in the way you framed it, you've offered demotion or redeployment. They've decided they don't want it. Well, I think you would dismiss them. And you'd, assuming everything else would be done properly, that would be a fair dismissal. I mean, there is no obligation to offer alternative employment through a capability process. And in fact, I think there's a case called Arrow Joby and London Borough of Lewisham, where in the AT, where His Honour Judge Richardson says exactly that, you know, there's not an obligation to offer alternative employment or redeployment. So here, you've gone out of your way, I think. To offer a demotion or redeployment is a very reasonable option if you think they can't perform at that level. They've chosen not to accept it. I think the dismissal would be fair. Alternatively, if they do resign, so if they say, you know, before you dismiss me, I'm resigning, I think they'd have a very great difficulty establishing a constructive dismissal claim. You know, trying to do everything you can to bring their performance up to standard, setting those targets, giving that support, because then if they don't meet that standard, you know, whether it is can't or won't, it's going to be a fair capability dismissal. I think the problem with assuming that it's won't too early is that you aren't thinking in terms of training and support and things like that. You're focused more on a conduct issue, just issuing a warning and moving on. So I think you're much safer to go down the capability route, and you might never get to the bottom of which it is, but I think you'll be pretty safe in an employment tribunal.
I think what you actually said there is the absolute key to it. You can never really find out which one it is, because it's impossible to know what's going on in an employer's mind, and employers are often very, very quick to assume that it's won't do, but just so often it's not.
Yeah.
We've got 10 minutes left with Saul Margo, who's answering your questions on performance-related dismissals. Gillian Howard. Gillian, good afternoon. This is a question a lot of people, I imagine, want to know the answer to. How far is an employee allowed to disagree with the targets and standards of performance set by the employer under a performance improvement plan? Just to give a bit of background, I'm not speaking for you, Gillian, but I imagine this is what you're thinking about. It has been known for employers to set unrealistic targets as a way of engineering an employee out of a company. Can an employee challenge that?
Yeah, I mean, I was just rudely glancing across at is the ACAS guide on disciplinary and grievances at work, which has a page 29 has a section on first formal action, unsatisfactory performance. It talks about an improvement note, and it says the improvement note should set out the performance problem, the improvement required, the timescale, etc. I'll just stop there at the improvement required, because obviously that's what we're talking about here. And you know, you're going to need to have, and this is all part of the code too, you know, a meeting with the employee to discuss it. I think the short answer is, you know, you need to have that meeting. You need to have some dialogue about what the improvement required is. But ultimately, it's the manager's decision. You know, the employee is allowed to disagree. The employee should have a chance to express their view. And that's going to be really important if you're ever having to defend this claim. If they express their view, you know, it can't be done in 6 weeks. You know, I need 8. Then it's going to be really helpful if the manager has engaged with that and given their reasons as to why actually it's 6. And a tribunal's never going to go behind that. You know, if there are some sort of sane, sensible reasons given, they're never going to step into the employer's shoes and say, no, you had to give them 8 weeks. So they can disagree, but it's the manager's decision. You just need some cogent reasons. And I think that dialogue is ultimately probably helpful if you ever come to defend the claim.
I suppose to put it into lawyers' language, it would be, are the targets within the range of reasonable responses that could be set by a reasonable employer when being reasonable on a reasonable Tuesday?
Yes, exactly.
That was Saul Margo from Outer Temple Chambers. Thank you, Saul. And that marks the end of Season 6 of Employment Law Matters. Thank you so much for joining me. I hope you'll join me for Season 7 of Employment Law Matters this coming autumn. Go to go.danielbarnett.com/sponsor for more information on sponsoring Season 7. If you don't subscribe to this podcast, please do, and please leave a review. In the meantime, have a great summer and stay safe.
Any information on this podcast is for general guidance only. Always seek legal advice. Please see full terms at www.danielbarnett.co.uk/podcast-terms.